From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, at least four Israelis and two Palestinian attackers are killed at a Jerusalem synagogue. The United Nations General Assembly is scheduled to vote on a resolution condemning North Korea's human rights record.
There is strong support for a resolution that includes strong language on crimes against humanity and accountability.
And a new study says there are 1 million preterm deaths a year. It's all ahead. I'm Sarah Williams. Israeli police say at least four Israelis have been killed and six wounded in an attack by two Palestinians at a synagogue in Jerusalem. The two attackers were killed by police. VOA Scott Bob reports from Jerusalem.
The attack occurred during morning prayers at a synagogue in an ultra-Orthodox Jewish neighborhood in West Jerusalem. Israeli police spokesman Mickey Rosenfeld said the synagogue was full of people praying.
Two terrorists attacked using knives, an axe, and also a pistol, opening fire at everyone that was inside the synagogue. Our police officers that arrived at the scene engaged contact with those terrorists and shot and killed the terrorists within moments.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, in a statement, promised to respond harshly and blamed the attack on what he called incitement by the militant Palestinian group Hamas and the head of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas. Mr. Abbas condemned the attack and said he condemns the killing of civilians no matter who is doing it. The militant group Hamas praised the attack, calling it a response to the continued Israeli crimes and the desecration of Jerusalem's Al-Aqsa Mosque. The mosque sits on the noble sanctuary or Temple Mount that is holy to Muslims and Jews. Violence between Israelis and Palestinians has surged in recent weeks, fueled by rising tension over the site. Non-Muslims may visit the site, but may not pray there, according to an agreement dating to the 1967 Israeli-Arab War. Some nationalist Israelis have been going to the site to pray, causing demonstrations and riots in East Jerusalem. Five Israelis and one foreigner have been killed in recent weeks by Palestinian attackers using knives and vehicles. More than a dozen Palestinians have been killed in clashes with police. In the most recent incident, a Palestinian bus driver was found hanged in his bus. An official autopsy determined that the death was suicide, but the victim's family rejected this, saying the body showed signs of violence. Scott Bob, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Hong Kong authorities have begun clearing part of a protest site that has been occupied by demonstrators since late September. Court bailiffs today dismantled street barricades in Admiralty near government headquarters in the Central Business District. Protesters put up no resistance. Some had already moved their tents and other belongings to a nearby site the police have left alone. Student protest leader Josh Wong says demonstrators have been instructed to not fight with police.
They just need to clear the road at the roadblock outside of the City Tower car park. We will accept it because actually it do not directly affect our Occupy action. In addition, we will still persist on the principle of peace and law violence. However, if the policemen try to clear the roadblock that are not close, that are not nearby, if the policemen try to clear the roadblock which is not near the City Tower car park, it will be quite disappointed.
Last week, a Hong Kong court ordered protesters to clear the area, as well as a site in the Mong Kok district across the harbor from Admiralty. One Mong Kok protester, who only wanted to be identified as May, said the protesters there will remain nonviolent right to the end. The demonstrators have been calling for fully democratic elections in 2017. They took to the streets after China ruled in August that all candidates for chief executive must first be approved by a committee that is stacked with pro-Beijing loyalists. The UN General Assembly is set to vote today on a non-binding European Union-Japanese resolution condemning North Korea's human rights record and calling on the Security Council to refer the resolution to the International Criminal Court for an investigation. The resolution borrows heavily from a nearly 400-page report from a year-long investigation by a three-member UN commission of inquiry. The commission, headed by Australian jurist Michael Kirby, was established last year by the UN Human Rights Council. It interviewed more than 80 defectors, witnesses, and experts who detailed decades of systematic executions, torture, rape, and mass starvation in the Norse prison network believed to hold as many as 200,000 people. Greg Scarliatu, executive director of the Washington-based Committee on Human Rights in North Korea, tells VOA's Victor Beatty he expects the resolution to pass with between 100 and 120 out of 193 votes.
What I know for sure is that there is strong support for a resolution that includes strong language on crimes against humanity and accountability. And I think that the chances of seeing the resolution pass tomorrow are good.
What impact will the number of countries that side with it, what impact will that have on the Security Council, which also is going to vote on this matter?
This would be a very important step. If the General Assembly resolution recommends that the Security Council consider the UNCOI report, and if the recommendation is that the Security Council should further refer the North Korean case to the International Criminal Court, of course, this would be an important step. The more support for the resolution, the more compelling the case will be. The current draft, once again, includes language on crimes against humanity and accountability. Regardless of the numbers of votes for the resolution, it would be extraordinarily important for this resolution to pass in the current shape of the draft.
If China should veto in the Security Council, where does this whole matter go?
Then so be it. Actually, North Korea is already on the agenda of the Security Council. North Korean nukes and missiles are already on the agenda, including human rights in the Security Council agenda would be a procedural matter that would only require 9 out of 15 votes of permanent and non-permanent members. Now, of course, once an issue is included in the agenda, it becomes substantive and thus subject to the veto of a P5 member, a permanent member, potentially a Chinese veto. However, my view on this is, so be it. Let China place itself in a position where it is repeatedly attempting to block initiatives to refer the North Korean case to the International Criminal Court. Let China place itself in a position where it is clearly, obviously aiding and abetting a regime that's committing crimes against humanity. The political price of doing that is only going to get higher.
That's Greg Scarliatu. North Korea has denied the existence of human rights atrocities, denouncing the credibility of those who testified to the COI. It says the United States and its allies are seeking to discredit and overthrow the leadership. Ahead of the vote, Human Rights Watch urged UN member states to vote in favor of what it calls this landmark resolution. It joins Amnesty International and the Jacob Blaustein Institute for the Advancement of Human Rights in urging members to resist pressure to delete references to accountability for decades of terrible abuse. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has stressed the importance of security and economic ties in an historic address to the Australian Parliament. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Narendra Modi is the first Indian leader to visit Australia in 28 years. He used an address to Parliament in Canberra to highlight the importance of bilateral ties for advancing regional peace and stability and combating terrorism. He's warned that the affluence he seeks for his nation of 1.25 billion people could be jeopardised by extremism, and he's urged Canberra to work alongside India on security issues. Trade too has been a pivotal part of Prime Minister Modi's speech, and he said Australia was vital in India's bid for greater prosperity.
I see Australia as a major partner in every area of our national priority, providing skills and education to our youth, a roof over every head and electricity in every household.
Mr. Modi's government has its sights set on imports of Australia's uranium for nuclear power after Canberra lifted a long-standing ban on sales to energy-hungry India. The Prime Minister told Parliament there were opportunities for Australia to provide education, healthcare and clean energy to India in the years ahead. Increased coal exports have also been discussed. After signing a free trade agreement with China on Monday, the Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott is keen to sign a similar agreement with New Delhi.
By the end of next year, we will have a free trade deal with what is potentially the world's largest market. And I want to make this declaration here in this Parliament. There are two can-do Prime Ministers in this chamber today, and we will make it happen.
Prime Minister Modi represents the world's largest democracy and one of its fastest-growing economies. He's the first Indian leader to address the Australian Parliament. He's been feted by members of the expatriate Indian community in Australia, who consider him to be a charismatic figure and a modernising influence on their homeland. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney, Australia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. In a case that triggered weeks of widespread protests and allegations of racial discrimination in Ferguson, Missouri, a grand jury is deliberating on whether police officer Darren Wilson should stand trial for the fatal August shooting of 18-year-old Michael Brown. VOA's Victoria Mackey explores whether the teenager's death can or should change what some Americans believe is an unacceptable status quo.
That a white police officer in Ferguson fatally shot an unarmed black teenager is not in dispute. Almost everything else is.
The case is seen very differently whether you're African American or whether you're, you know, white.
Lawyer Debbie Hines, who blogs about the Ferguson shooting, notes one survey indicating that 80% of black adults believe the case is about race. Among white respondents, that number drops to 37%. Many of those who see race as a key issue in the teenager's death want discrimination addressed on a national level. The civil rights group NAACP has asked the Justice Department for policy changes to address police violence against black Americans. Among their demands, more diversity in law enforcement and more police officers who are members of the community they serve. Experts on the interaction between police and minority communities say this is key. Public policy expert Elsie Scott helped diversify New York City's police force.
Because of this distrust and this disconnect between the black community and the police, you can still end up with a major incident if you have not engaged your community, if you don't have black people on your police departments.
That disconnect in Ferguson is stark, a nearly all-white police force in a largely African-American city. For some, the issue of race can obscure the particulars of an individual case. Bill Johnson represents police unions in Washington.
And like it or not, and regardless of the color of the people involved, regardless of the socioeconomic standards, regardless of the history of the police department, for an individual officer, if his or her life is threatened, or if they reasonably believe it's threatened, they have the right to use force.
He also argues that putting minority police in minority communities is not the solution.
If you pursue that and it goes too far down that road, it really ends up with a form of a kind of insidious discrimination that's there. And I think that it doesn't solve the problem. I think if you send a message also that to a community of color that, well, you can't trust the white officer.
The Justice Department is conducting probes into Michael Brown's death and the Ferguson Police Department. The initial investigation does not include a review of the hiring practices that made the Ferguson police an almost exclusively white force in a majority black city. Victoria Mackey, VOA News, Washington.
Complications from preterm births now outrank all other causes of death for young children. Of the more than 6.3 million deaths of kids under the age 5 in 2013, more than 1 million resulted from preterm problems. The study was published this week on World Prematurity Day. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The study appears in the Lancet Medical Journal. It's a collaborative effort by researchers from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and the World Health Organization. The vast majority of the deaths from direct complications of preterm births occurred within the first 28 days of life, with an additional 125,000 deaths occurring between 1 month and 5 years. Dr. Andreas DeFrancisco is interim director of the Geneva-based Partnership for Maternal Newborn and Child Health.
Over the last few years, the proportion of deaths due to preterm births has been increasing. The reason for this is that we do not really have major interventions in place to avoid premature births, and second, to manage them in most communities where they occur.
He says preterm birth complications are a worldwide problem.
We have countries in Africa, for example, Nigeria, or in Asia, India and Pakistan, that have extremely high numbers of kids that are dying related to preterm births. But this is not only a problem in developing countries. This is also a problem that affects developed countries as well.
India actually tops the list, followed by Nigeria, Pakistan, the DRC, China, Bangladesh, Indonesia, Ethiopia, Angola, and Kenya. Researchers warn the Ebola outbreak in West Africa raises the risk of preterm complications in the affected countries. The rise in deaths from preterm birth complications actually coincides with a dramatic decline in the worldwide mortality rate of children under 5.
Mortality has been reducing by about 3.9% per year, which is a very impressive reduction of mortality and is due to a lot of the interventions that we have in stock, including decreasing the mortality due to infectious diseases such as pneumonia and diarrhea, malaria, among others.
Some of the interventions credited for the mortality rate decline include vaccines, bed nets, antibiotics, anti-malarial and HIV treatments. But Dr. DeFrancisco says the mortality rate for premature babies has decreased by a much smaller rate of 2% a year. A big part of the reason, he says, is a lack of adequate interventions. And right now, it's not clear what the best interventions are, aside from addressing obesity and high blood pressure or hypertension. The study says, for the most part, it's not fully known what triggers preterm labor, and about half of preterm births occur spontaneously.
This cause of mortality needs to be studied much more specifically and in a much more focused way, because if we don't have the causes, if we don't have the factors, pregnancy is going to end in a premature birth, and this needs to be the focus of intensive research.
Some $250 million worth of intensive research is getting underway through 4 major initiatives: the Global Coalition to Advance Preterm Birth Research, the March of Dimes, the University of California at San Francisco's Preterm Birth Initiative, and the Global Alliance to Prevent Prematurity and Stillbirth.
If we are able to support these research programs within the next 5 years or so, we will be able to have interventions that are going to contribute to the reduction of mortality in these very small babies.
Researchers also will study poverty, nutrition, pollution, and stress. And they'll try to solve a mystery. Why do Somali women living in the United States have very low rates of premature births, while most black women in the U.S. have very high rates? Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
This is Today in History. On November 18, 1493, Christopher Columbus first sighted the island now known as Puerto Rico. In 1497, Portuguese explorer Vasco da Gama reached the Cape of Good Hope on the way to establishing a sea route from Europe to India. The new route would permit trade with the Far East without the use of caravans along the costly and unsafe Silk Road. It would also lead to a several-hundred-year era of European domination through sea power and commerce. On this day in 1626, Pope Urban VIII dedicated St. Peter's Basilica at the Vatican in Rome. With construction beginning in 1506, St. Peter's is one of the world's largest churches. It's the birthday of American statistician George Gallup. He was born in 1901. Gallup was a pioneer in scientific polling techniques. His name became a household word. While editor at the Daily Iowan newspaper in the early 1920s, Gallup conducted what is widely considered the first poll in human history. He took a survey to find the prettiest girl on campus. The winner was Ophelia Smith, whom Gallup later married. In 1903, a treaty was signed by the United States and Panama, giving the United States exclusive rights over the Panama Canal Zone. In 1926, George Bernard Shaw refused to accept the money for his Nobel Prize, saying, "I can forgive Alfred Nobel for inventing dynamite, but only a fiend in human form would have invented the Nobel Prize." On this day in 1928, Mickey Mouse was born, Walt Disney's Steamboat Willie, premiered in New York at the Colony Theater. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Pakistan's National University of Sciences and Technology, or NUST, hosted U.S. Ambassador to Pakistan Richard Olson for a discussion with students and faculty on November 12th. Ambassador Olson thanked Lieutenant General Muhammad Askar, rector of NUST, for hosting the event and supporting academic exchanges and linkages with U.S. institutions. Ambassador Olson emphasized the importance of cooperation between the United States, Afghanistan, and Pakistan in order to support regional stability and prosperity. A strong relationship between our two countries is of great importance to regional stability and to achieving a more prosperous future for our citizens, Ambassador Olson noted. One of the most critical ingredients for achieving regional stability and prosperity is creating a peaceful and stable future for Afghanistan, he said. The ambassador spoke about the results of the Declaration of Enduring Partnership signed between the government of Afghanistan and NATO in 2010 to provide long-term security, economic, and political support to Afghanistan and the importance of regional efforts to its continued success. An increasingly stable Afghanistan that is at peace and enjoys productive relations with its neighbors will be an effective counterweight against extremism. A stable Afghanistan is also conducive to economic development in South and Central Asia, he said. The ambassador reaffirmed the enduring U.S. commitment to Pakistan and the region, saying, "The United States will remain engaged. We see our role in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the region as one of a sustained commitment that is in our own national security interest as well as that of the countries of the region." Calling on the students at NUST to play a role in leading Pakistan to a more stable and secure future, Ambassador Olson concluded, "You have an opportunity now to choose a better future and put aside the differences of the past. Pakistan is a young society, and so is Afghanistan. Young people in both countries can make the choice now to set the course for a positive and constructive direction. I hope you will seize that opportunity, and rest assured that the United States is committed to supporting you in your critical role to help Afghanistan through this period of transition.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.